welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me in wrongness is Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
That's me. I'm doing good.
In a state of wrongness. You see, there was a lot of feedback after last week's episode, and in point of fact, the first person to observe that we committed rules errors was none other than friend of the show from No Pun Included, Efka Bladukas. I actually have the message he wrote to me on Discord right here. It says, to whom it may concern, which is a bad sign. When you get a DM from a personal friend and it says to whom it may concern, you're in for a rough ride. I had previously thought that you had two brain cells to rub together, and now I must revise my estimate downwards. He said, that was unnecessary.
That's kind of leading off, you know.
It's a little personal.
A little personal.
It's a little personal, a little bit below the belt. And he then goes on to suggest that we return the Golden Geek Award by hand.
Wow.
And issue refunds to all our patrons for our grievous error with respect to My Favorite Things. And I assume it was only out of shame for ever having associated with us in the first place that he withheld from mentioning that we also got something wrong in Dro Polter. Now, let's start with Dro Polter first. That's on me. I neglected to mention that the ideal strategy for when you want to drop when you want to drop four things is not to drop your entire hand, but instead pinch the one thing you're not supposed to drop and then dump the rest of your hand. Because if you drop something that you're not supposed to, you're supposed to put everything back into your hand. Of course, as a reminder, this is a sort of a siren's call. This is a false simulacrum of a good idea, because if you have any points, you will then immediately find yourself pointless, because in Dro Polter, the game of dropping things, if you drop any of your points, they're gone forever. And I've made that mistake a number of times, though not in the most recent playing. And then there's My Favorite Things, where we made a theoretical rules error, because I think it would have shaken out the same way
in
both
our
times.
Particular game.
Yeah, in our particular game. Why don't you walk us through?
I either A, misread it or misinterpreted it or misremembered it. It's when I had said that the heartbreak symbol is like Megatrump and beats any hand. But that is only true if there is a one on the table. So if there's a one on the table, the heartbreak will beat that. Otherwise
a two will win, or yes, a three, or theoretically even a four.
But I know for at least the time that I played my one, it was beat by heartbreak. And I know in one other case, if not more, the one was beat by heartbreak, if not all of them.
I remember the time that I played my heartbreak, there was another heartbreak which won the tiebreaker, which was nonsense. I will never, ever think that that was legitimate. I'm going to contest this as high as it goes. I've got Sam Alito in my pocket. He's going to side with me. And somebody else had played a one.
Yeah, sorry, not beat by one. I had just made the mistake again. It was not beat by one. It was beat by the heartbreak.
Walker, we have to be careful. Our credibility is hanging by a thread here. You can't be so loose with your speech.
I'm sorry.
Well, we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about what we reviewed some time ago. Walker would assert exactly 1 year. I think that's a bit over precise, and again, our credibility. The as-yet-unnamed retrospective intersegment, the Eurus. We're then going to go on to the games we played last week, the news, and why it doesn't matter. And finally, our topic this week is going to be about some games that are very, very specific about player counts, only at certain player counts.
Yeah. I've deemed it, sorry you can't come today.
Yes. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
We reviewed a game called Lacrimosa. Lacrimosa?
Lacrimosa.
Lacrimosa. And it's a shame that I haven't played it again. I remember.
Cry about it?
I remember all good things. Yeah, I'm gonna cry about it. I remember all good things about Lacrimosa. It's about trying to befriend a famous conductor and/or writer of orchestras, and do all sorts of stuff around town. I remember being a good little game, Mark.
It was fine. I mean, you know, it's a workmanlike medium weight Euro game. I have not thought about it at all since we reviewed it. I think I was only vaguely reminded when there was that Kickstarter that was very expensive that prominently featured violin making. But past that, it has not really crossed my thoughts. It was fine. It didn't really do anything particularly spectacular. It was functional. I enjoyed my playings of it, but it just completely evanesced from my memory like so much haze.
Agreed.
And I believe we sent it off to a patron or gave it away in trade. I can't remember. See, that's how dim my memory is of what we did with Lacrimosa. That's Lacrimosa. This was a Devere game in a normal-sized box. Maybe I'd remember it more if it was part of Devere's later strategy of boxes that are, if anything, borderline too small.
And that's our Eurus, Lacrimosa.
So, Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, I streamed a couple of games. We played Endeavor Deep Sea. Now, we talked about that last week. The game was much the same. It's based off of Age of Sail Endeavor. You go through a series of events, which is getting discs, removing some discs so you can put the discs back on to do actions. And unfortunately, this gameplay sort of worked out to be everyone did everything. And I can see where the different missions are going to change that. Like, we filled the board. Everyone was on the board. Everyone had practically, except for me, I missed on one track. Everyone else had maxed out all of their tracks.
Oh, really? Which mission did you play? The second one?
I forced them to play the second.
You forced them?
You could say that. You know, it didn't change much. You know, just
you
some
put
of the
Sidewinder in a headlock.
That's right.
She was like, and no, said, I want to play the first
either
mission.
Either we're playing this one or get out.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
That sounds like you.
But I still enjoy Endeavor Deep Sea. I'm not regretting it. I'm looking forward to playing through more of the missions because because of the outcome of everyone being pretty well in the same place, we sort of looked ahead to see some of the missions. We saw that it could potentially play out much differently. So looking forward to more plays of Endeavor Deep Sea. This is designed by Carl DeVisser and Jarrett Gray and put out by Burnt Island Games.
It doesn't surprise me that it would make sense to skip ahead to a later scenario. I mean, they definitely give the vibe in the back of the rulebook that the early scenarios are very slowly iterating on the idea. And for what it's worth, the base game of Endeavor Deep Sea can at times feel a little bit samey if you decide to pursue the same strategies over and over, and there's not a whole lot of variety we had from the building set. That's why the expansion was so welcome in some ways. It added a little bit of variety. And the changes that Deep Sea introduces, namely the different tiles and the different seascapes, don't strike me as the kind of thing that would considerably change the texture or feel of what's going on. You're going up the tracks, you're placing a disc. That's more or less how it's going to shake out, which is fine for a light middleweight Euro game of its type. It's still very clean, very satisfying, very fast moving, but not necessarily the kind of thing that you would want to have in rotation every week, unless you are going to be mixing things up either with scenarios or with the strange key-based modules in Age of Sail. And yeah, I'd play Mission Deep Sea again. Sorry, I keep saying Mission Deep Sea. It's just Endeavor Deep Sea.
Yes.
I've got the crew on the brain, because the crew is Mission Deep Sea, so my apologies. Let the record reflect that I eventually got to the crew. Please send all your comments to support@aircanada.ca.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, absolutely. We say this in jest. I appreciate it when people try to keep us honest. What did other people think of Endeavor Deep Sea, other than being vaguely dissatisfied by the end state?
Everyone seemed to enjoy it. You can see it. It's on our YouTube channel under the live tab. You can check out our playing there. I think it's very colorful. I think the production is very good. Comes with a tray for all the recruits that you're going to get.
Burnt Island Games knows how to put out a good production. That's for certain.
It's a nice little package.
Played Hanabi by Antoine Boza. It's been a couple of years since we played Hanabi, and I decided to rectify that. And this is a co-op game where your communication is severely curtailed in that you're literally not allowed to say anything about the game state. And you can't see your own hand of cards. Everyone else can see what your hand is. And the goal is simply to play out 1 through 5 in order in a variety of different colors. And this was the first time that the two Louis had been exposed to Hanabi. And as always, one of the fascinating things when introducing new players to Hanabi is them feeling out and inferring some conventions and sometimes inventing new conventions that make sense to them. It's legitimately an interesting sociological/psychological experiment, because I have noticed that amongst the Hanabi cognoscenti, the people who've played online a great deal or in person a great deal, they expect to get to 25, which is to say the maximum score on the reg. Losing in Hanabi is rare. Typically what you do is just a function of what your score is going to be, and the rulebook, unlike the rulebook of Just One, is actually congratulatory much of the time, rather than just aggressively negging you. But in my experience, getting to actually 25 is very rare, and on occasion, I don't mean to tar everyone with the same brush, but on occasion I've spoken to people who are knee-deep in the Hanabi world, and if you start teasing out what they expect normal play to look like, it rests on a mountain of unspoken conventions that if they don't violate the rules of Hanabi, they certainly violate the spirit of Hanabi, in that there's a whole bunch of communication pre-done between games to import things. Now, this can also be group dependent, but as I say, the meta with which I'm familiar online is not really the way I experience Hanabi, which is where you're trying to fumble around in the dark rather than expect everyone to, a bit like Bridge. If you wander in off the street to a bunch of experienced bridge players, first of all, they're going to say, you smell awfully bad. Did you sleep on the sidewalk? To which you're going to say yes. And you're going to bid like a monkey, and they're going to look at you like you don't know what you're doing, because you don't. And whether you prefer a play style of that genre or in a more free-floating genre, that's very much up to you. But as I say, when it comes to Hanabi, I'm very much of the let's not have a mountain of unspoken assumptions going on. And then I got to hear things like Louis's inference that he didn't think it made ever any sense to give any clue where it was the case that not all of the tiles could be played. So, for example, he was watching us give clues like these three tiles are white, which, you know, is half of the information that you might need, or at least building towards some other clue that will unlock a couple of discards and or a couple of plays. But he wasn't interested in building a latticework of inference. He was just like, well, if all of those are playable, I'll give a clue about that and whatever it is it happens to be. Otherwise, I'm not going to clue, which was...
I was surprised if either of the Louis would like it at all. So it's pretty great that you brought it to them. I'm glad. I heard that they kind of enjoyed it.
They did.
I'm glad
they did enjoy Hanabi. Hanabi is genius. I've yet to encounter anyone that didn't enjoy it, even if they found the relatively low level of social inference that exists at my inexpert tables to be a bit baffling. The fundamental structure is just so clean and novel that it really works well. This is by Antoine Bauzat, and we love the work of Antoine Bauzat. This ranges all the way from things like Paku Paku to Hanabi, which I think are his two greatest works, frankly. He also did Seven Wonders. We don't try to talk about that too much. And it's stood the test of time. I really adore Hanabi. It needs to be in circulation more often. But as I say, it's just interesting watching people make inferences and make assumptions. I try not to be frustrated by people making different inferences than I would make, because, again, that's part of the charm. I like watching people make those developments. And we've got the deluxe version, which has the lovely Bakelite tiles. They're super clacky. They're a little bit like low-quality Mahjong tiles. We talked about how great it would be to have a Mahjong table. Are you familiar with
oh, yeah, where they,
the mechanical Mahjong tables?
Yeah, the little cylinder rises up and you sort of scoop everything in. You hear this like mechanism start up, like it's grinding them into new tiles.
And
or
then
something.
Far too quickly, all the tiles are sorted. Yeah. They've been randomized and sorted into the stacks. And if you have not seen a Mahjong tile, an automatic mechanical Mahjong tile in operation, I encourage you to go check it out and watch them. It's glorious. They're extraordinarily expensive. But if you're going to be playing Mahjong all day, it really helps to be able to set it down and tear it down and set it up that quickly.
I believe there are two sets of tiles in these tables. Just so we're clear, I think you scoop down and then the new set automatically pops up.
Is that how it works?
I don't want to say so, but from watching it, I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
Okay. Well, I've never actually played Mahjong. I suspect I would even kind of enjoy some versions of it. I shouldn't say Mahjong because it's not one game. It's a series of different kinds of games, and people have strong preferences. Anyway, Hanabi has nothing to do with Mahjong. But I very much enjoy Hanabi. If you like a co-op game that is about inference and subtle communication, I highly, highly recommend it. Originally published by Abacus Spiel in 2010.
You were nice enough to bring Thor back to the table. This is an old Reiner Knizia game. I meant to put the eight other games that it's... also, you know, with different names.
Loco is one of the most popular reprints that I've seen of Thor.
So in this game, you're sort of building your tableau of these different gods, and it's what makes this game great is the sort of random game end, because as soon as, you know, there are six gods of a particular kind, that means the round's going to end. And then it's...
Well, you say random. I mean, it's very much one of those games where you're managing the tempo of a round. And having the ability to... And reserving the ability to end the round on your terms is very much what's going on in Thor.
Yeah, not random. Non-set.
Precisely.
I guess I should say.
Variable as opposed
variable,
to random, yes.
Just so. And just deciding what cards to keep, how to show, or, you know, wait till the very end. Are you going to be able to get these cards out? Are you going to be able to put that zero out to make that particular god worth nothing? Or am I going to be able to get this five out to make this, you know, giant set of purples worth something? All of this is great.
It's one of those elementally simple Reiner Knizia card games where there's five different gods. Each of them have cards 0 to 5. And the value of a god is going to be the last card that was played of that suit. So it can go from 0 to 5 or from 5 to 0 in a single card play. All you do on your turn is you play one of these number cards and then take an instance of that god. And so you have to infer what people have in their hands. Someone hasn't played to Baldur yet, but they keep taking Baldur cards. They might be sitting on the Baldur 5. So maybe you want to get in on Baldur, or maybe you then save the Baldur 0 or 1 so as to make their holdings worthless by the end of it. It's one of my favorite stock games because that's basically what it is. It's effectively a stock game where your holdings are determined by this card play. And the tempo manipulations are just one of them. Just again, it's about inference and timing. And those are two things that can be done very, very well in the context of a card game. And I think it's really well done in Thor. There's a variant where there are action cards. There are two reasons why I haven't been inclined to try it. Number one is because I think that the base game is so compelling. And number two, because I only have them in German and I'm not interested in having a sort of paste up or reference situation. I seriously don't think that what a quick, incredibly simple, very, very tight game of Thor needs is looking things up on a player aid.
Agreed. That's Thor by Rainer Knizia.
And I have the Heidelberger Spielverlag version, which is this kind of narrow box. I'm a big fan. Acquired it during a CMIS one year, and I do not regret it. Played a game of Quinn. Quinn is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is a positional abstract with magnets. They had me at magnets. And it's kind of, I don't mean this to sound as pejorative as it might sound. It's very Stratego-like in that you set up your initial ranks of pieces, and you can make inferences about what a given piece is based on how far it moves, but at the end of the day, it's all hidden and remains hidden much of the time.
And there's lanes as well that makes it different from Stratego. It's not just open movement. There's some sort of like, it's based on light. So light goes straight forward, so pieces go forward. Some might have a giant amount of movement, but they can only go in a certain direction, so... You know, and some lanes just end, so you got to maneuver that way, and you're trying to get your main light source to the center of the board. And like Mark said, there's magnets, so, you know, there's that. These things look like AirPod earphones that have a stem that's, you know, five times longer than that. So these things are standing up the board like little plants.
I think I definitely see that. They look like AirPods on twigs. I also think they look like iStocks.
Just so. And so the game looks very interesting. I love the fact that it's interchangeable. So there's you can play the you know the base game, but you can also modify all your pieces to be different things. And you also have a choice of what pieces you're going to use for any particular game. So there's like same just like Stratego, there's bombs and things that go super fast. And some things beat other things. So it's very interesting that way. And I love sort of maneuvering your pieces around, moving everything one so they're not sure what's what, and then maneuvering them in a way that is protecting your light source. You can even reflect pieces up to the front. Very interesting game. Looking forward to playing it more.
I had a bit of difficulty internalizing the rule set, in part because there are several different gameplay modes that are presented more or less at the same time in the rulebook. And so what you end up having is this fundamental structure that is common across all play modes. But then you start reading about how a given piece works, and it has its capture rules and its special ability. But then in the other play mode, it has different capture rules and different special ability, and these conditional what happens when it's attempted to be captured by these other things. And eventually, I like read through the rulebook like half a dozen times, and each time I gave up. And this time I just decided, it's like, okay, forget the other game modes. I'm going to pick one. I'm going to pick the sort of intermediate, not fully intro, but kind of, it's called the arcade mode for what it's worth. I'm just going to ignore all the other gameplay modes in their entirety, which is honestly what I should have done from the beginning. But I was trying to do it all at once, which is on me, I suppose. And in the arcade mode, the capture rules, there's asymmetry there, but it's comparatively simple. The special abilities are comparatively simple. And nonetheless, there's a lot of character and a lot of asymmetry going on in terms of the pieces. The third eye mode, which is the more complicated one, is kind of presented as the main intended gameplay mode. We might try arcade again or move on to third eye. I don't know. It's just at that point, the capture rules and the intricacies of the abilities start getting a little bit more baroque. Maybe I'm in a better position to appreciate it now with a game under my belt. I am not typically very pro positional abstracts, but Quinn was charming. I very much enjoyed it. I liked the double think. I liked the uncertainty of not knowing what piece Walker was trying to bring up and to what end, of just working through the conditionals. Like, well, either this is a void, in which case he's trying to sucker out my shadow, or this is indeed his own shadow, in which case I should jump on it and take it out first. And then knowing, based on making inferences about what pieces he had available after a couple of captures, and then knowing how that would influence my attempts to get to the center, I was very pleasantly surprised by Quinn, even independently of the magnets. The magnets remained delightful the entire time. It allowed the pieces to be that skinny without falling over, so they were actually functional as well as just being magnets. More games need magnets. This is a very clear editorial position we have here at So Very Wrong About Games. And yeah, I'm looking forward to another game. It was tense. It was interesting. It was the right level of mentally engaging, such that I felt like I was being taxed, but not at the point where, like Calico, I was getting a headache and wanted to die. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to another play.
That's Quinn, designed by Brian Rooney and Taylene Woodward, and put out by Arch Gravity Publishing. It was a crowdfunder.
Played a game of Hamster Roll. This is by Jacques Zimmet. I always forget that Jacques Zimmet did Hamster Roll, because I remember that he designed Cockroach Poker and Ghost Blitz, to utterly genius, child-friendly, also gamer-friendly, party-ish games. And he's also designed Hamster Roll, which is this incredible dexterity game. And I'm always blown away by the range of his talents. And Hamster Roll is this very iconoclastic yellow wooden wheel with spokes inside. And you're just stacking wooden pieces and trying not to get the wheel to roll too far, because any piece that falls out of the wheel, you have to eat. And sorry, this is I don't want a correction here.
Whoa.
This is figurative. You figuratively have to eat the piece, in that you have to take it, and it counts against you. I am not endorsing nor acknowledging any kind of actual... Anyway, moving
There's
on.
There's no chocolate inside, no matter how much you want there to be.
And we know this after exhaustive experimentation.
I don't know how those bite marks got into all my pieces, but here we are, chocolateless in the end.
There's a bit of a problem with respect to the way we play Hamster Roll, though. And by we, I mean the dynamics between myself in particular and you in particular. Because between the two of us, you, Walker, I would classify as a sort of gonzo experimentalist in the best possible way. You're the Hunter S. Thompson of Hamster Roll, whereas I am sort of the... the William Buckley of Hamster Roll, in that I am extraordinarily conservative.
Well, we can see that that worked out for you. Yes,
it tends to.
I do like doing the risque, come out looking at, looking like the hero, doing
it's
the
true.
Weird, crazy move.
And you do have your moments
and
of heroism.
And it fails most of the time.
Punctuated by terrible failure, yeah.
It works out and looks amazing.
Whereas I just see, the problem is the dynamics. This is one of those areas where if you cared about Hamster Roll competitively, which no human being should, turn order dynamics really start to influence things. Because if you go after someone who's more of a virtuoso, gung-ho Hamster Roll player, you're going to have a very easy time of it. And that was my lot in this particular session. So frequently I'd look at the wheel and say, I can place more or less whatever I want. And when you have that kind of liberty, in turn blocking people gets really easy. And so I would just feel like, all right, and do this incredibly simple thing, which then I think, Walker, you mostly interpreted as a challenge to try to out. It's like, yeah, you've made that area of the wheel really hard to place in. Watch me try anyway.
Exactly.
Honestly, you might not have walked away with the W, but you walked away with my enduring respect.
There you go. I had fun. That's all that matters. So I did.
That is, you know what? You're right. No, and these are not even criticisms of Hamster Roll. This is just an observation about what it's like when the two of us are at the same table and we have diametrically opposite attitudes with respect to how to play dexterity games. This is true whether it's something stacking like Hamster Roll or a flicking game where I'm going to be like, well, maybe if I move it a couple inches forward, Walker's like, hope the wall holds! Bam!
I could definitely bank that six times across the... Yes. And that is Hamster Roll. Lastly from me, we played another review copy. This one was called Gun It. This is designed by Randy O'Connor and put out by Randy O Games. And this is very interesting. You're in a car. It's scenario based. So in this particular one, we had stolen some files from work that were incriminating and we wanted to get them to the newspaper or whatever. So now we're surrounded by cars and it's a puzzle game where you have four directions, three weapons and a steering wheel, and four different turn order cards. And so you're trying to figure out which car is going to use their item first. One of the items being the steering wheel, which is going to bump cars around, and then a pistol and a shotgun and a
submachine gun.
Uzi. That's right, the Uzi. And they all do different things. So you're just sort of puzzling out how to get the best sort of what they called a pile up. So destroying the most cars in a single player's turn.
But don't worry, they're bad guys.
They're bad guys. Yeah, they're terrible.
They're chasing.
And they don't kill any innocent bystanders. All just bad guys.
We protected those innocent bystanders.
It's true.
They never got damaged over the course of our game. We took it on the chin. What is really tying all this together and making it more of a spatial puzzle is that each player, or each hand, because you don't always play with four players, more on that in a second, is occupying a different position in the car. So it matters where you are in the car, both for two reasons. Number one, you cannot steer the car if you're in the back seat, obviously, no matter how much you want to try. And some shots become risky if you're trying to, say, fire to the right of the vehicle and you're sitting on the driver's side. That's just not... It's bad car etiquette. It's bad road trip etiquette. It's a faux pas.
It's true. It's a real-time game, which I think is... also ties it together.
Yes.
So there's those set number of cards, and then the timer starts, and then you're frantically trading cards around. You must always have one of each card, a turn order, an item, and a direction. So whether you're going left, right, front, or back. And so you're frantically trading them around, trying to figure out the puzzle, the best way to get one big pileup done, and or not blow up your own car by accident.
Oh, yeah.
And then the timer's done, and then you run through the turn order to see what happens. I'm very much looking forward to my next game of Gunit.
So there are two things that need to be emphasized with respect to how we played Gunit. Number one, we played two players, and so you just two-hand things. You orient the car in the middle of the table, and that means that one player is either both the driver's side passengers, or one player is the front half, and the other player is the back. You get the idea. You know, you may be familiar with how an automobile works in terms of passengers when there are four of them, which is, you know, a reason why you might want a high-performance vehicle with a back seat, like a Mustang, for example.
Just so.
Yeah. Obviously, once again, proof positive that the Ford Mustang is the most practical kind of vehicle one could ever possibly possess. Moving on with difficulty. And if you play with four players, it's very simple. Everyone's got their own hand. When you play with three, there are some rules with that. I'd be curious to try it, but it does seem like it's kind of sort of a fixed four-player game, and so I don't really know what the ideal experience is. I have concerns about whether with four players it might be a little too easy and straightforward in terms of information management, because you're only figuring out what one person's going to do. You look at it and say, well, it makes most sense for me to do this thing, so it makes the most sense for me to have the two and the shotgun. It's like, okay, well, we're done. I don't know. This is just speculation. The other thing is we played with the intro baby scenario, and so we didn't play with advanced complications or with advanced pieces of equipment. Those in particular I'm curious to see, because it did get a little repetitive, just doing the same three things every round. That having been said, it's very, very quick. There's a lot in Gunit. It's a small box game, but there are a lot of different scenarios, a lot of different ways to play, a lot of different methods and modes and stuff. And again, I started getting a little bit of the Quinn vibe in that it was all being presented one after the other. And so I was much better at just adopting the blinkers and say, okay, we'll try the baby scenario to start.
Yeah, it had some interesting choices as well, because you're always surrounded by cars. And so you have this giant deck that you constantly draw from that surrounds your car. And it could be good or bad. And they actually made the backs of the tiles different colors so you could see. So I don't know if they wanted it to be that way so you could sort of see what's coming, so you could sort of gauge what's going on.
But I have to assume that was intentional, yeah.
But it just seemed odd.
I don't know. I liked it. In the intro scenario, there are two tiles that get introduced that are more dangerous than the other ones. One of them are the innocents, where if they get damaged, you take damage. And given that your car can only take 4 points of damage, and there's plenty of other occasions for you to take damage, that's not great. And then there was the biker gang, which is impossible to shoot at. They only take damage from collateral damage, which is sometimes very difficult to orchestrate in precisely the way you want it to happen. And in turn, they do collateral damage in all four directions, which if you're next to them, that's also not great, especially since we lost by taking too much damage as it was. Our score was terrible anyway. We were unimpressive. We failed to be impressive. Apparently, causing something like a dozen fireballs on an open freeway is not remarkable enough to succeed in garnering enough attention to our corrupt overlords, but I'm not going to quibble. Yeah, the scoring rules really encourage you to figure out things in a puzzly way. That part wasn't necessarily my preference, but it's a real-time co-op, interestingly done. I'm interested in exploring the further scenarios and the further permutations of Gunnet. Finally, played Spirits of the Forest. This is by Michael Schacht. This is the Thundergrift redevelopment of the Web of Power card game, which was originally published at the turn of the century. Web of Power, for those that remember, was republished by Thundergrift as Iwari, and it is my favorite light area majority game. It's extraordinarily well done. Michael Schacht is known for having designed usually very abstract, themeless, very, very light card and board games. He's best known, I think, for Coloretto, which is full of tension and cruelty. Then there's Spirits of the Forest, which, frankly, I'm not surprised it was rethemed, not only because his games tend to be abstract, but also because it doesn't really bear any resemblance to any of the games of the Web of Power lineage. It is more or less, it's kind of like Area Majority. You want more symbols than anybody else, and you're drafting these tiles. You set out this big grid of tiles. You can only take tiles from the edge, the left edge or the right edge. Everybody drafts tiles. You want more symbols than other people. There you go. You lose points for any symbol you don't have. Honestly, that's what was driving most of my decisions.
Has this weird gem system where you can kind of reserve tiles, but
kind
not really.
Kind of, sort of, but not really. That, well put. It was a lot of the decision making for me was just driven by the fact that there are 8 different kinds of spirits and 3 different kinds of symbols, and anything you're missing, you're going to lose 3 points for. So initially, like my very first selections, I'm like, ooh, if I take that, I can get 4 of the 8 possible symbols, thereby almost guaranteeing that I'm going to be able to score that category because I've got the most. And it's like, oh, there are 8 different kinds of spirits. Crap. Okay, and the point values are so low that the 3-point loss is considerable, and so then I was just, I feel like I spent the back half of the game just taking symbols I didn't already have.
Yeah, it seems very much, like you said, making sure you have at least one of everything, and then hopefully eking out 1, maybe 2, and going big into those. But I was very worried going in that it was going to be this light, and it was that light, and
every once in a while, Walker, before trying a game, decides it's an affront, that it is a personal insult.
And I apologize to everyone before we start. I'm sorry, but I would like to try this game.
It
was very confusing.
It was inoffensive.
I really like the art. But
really?
It is so small that you can't see.
Oh, yeah.
I like that sort of tribal, you know, looking spirit drawings.
Vaguely fantastical animal
but
spirit things.
But there are these little tiny circles on the cards. I'm like, why?
It's
just
really
wasted.
Small, yeah. Most of the tile is just a sort of abstract color pattern.
Yeah.
And the actual spirits, the nature spirits that you're nominally collecting, some of them are potentially visually interesting, but we were squinting at them trying to figure, is that a cat fox? Is that a weird sort of, I don't know what that, oh, doesn't matter. It's orange. I agree with you. It's a strange misstep because normally I associate Thundergrift games with very striking component design and visual design, and Spirits of the Forest was just there.
Yeah.
Both in gameplay and in terms of visuals.
Agreed.
So that was Spirits of the Forest by Michael Schacht, a redevelopment that has been republished several times. And those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tontandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Project K, League of Legends trading card game.
That's a lot of words.
Are you excited?
No.
No.
Why do they name all their, like, their fighting game is also like letters. It's Project something.
I'm not sure.
What's their deal? You're deep in the League lore. Why is everything Project letters?
I don't read it. I don't read any websites. I don't read the updates. I click play.
You're operating on an instinctive level.
It's unfortunate that it's going to be a trading game, so it's going to be this collecting thing. But
blind buy collectible.
The little
thing,
bit
yeah.
that I looked into it, it looks as though you actually play a character, which doesn't really feed into the. I mean, I can see where you collect a bunch of cards and make your deck, you know, a mishmash of everything.
Sure.
But now you're playing an actual character, so you have to actually get certain cards. It just seems odd. But anyway, I'm definitely going to buy a starter set and try it.
Yeah, you're such a League head.
I am?
Yeah. You've got like hundreds and hundreds of hours in League of Legends Star
Trek. I am not going to say.
Okay. This is one question I will ask. How much money have you put into this free game?
Oh, $10 maybe.
Cool. I admire your self-control.
You can buy skins, and sometimes it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. And they have given me hours of joy.
I'm not quibbling.
I know.
You can also buy characters though, right? Well, there's the rotation that's free. And then there you can buy permanent access to other ones, I thought.
I think you can. I never have done that, so I think maybe you can.
Okay.
Anyway. But you get in-game
currency. Yes.
That's what I've done. So I've never actually bought a character. I've only purchased skins.
Well, there you go. I'm definitely not going to edit that out of context and make you sound like a serial killer.
And if you want to reflect, I have every single character, so if you want to work out how many hours
to get. That's a lot of characters.
Yeah, so just, yeah.
Dragons Down. I've been talking about Dragons Down. This is the Mr. B Games sort of redo of Magic Realm. And one of the things that I commented was I missed that there are no natives in Dragons Down. I felt it foreclosed some of the more interesting gameplay possibilities that was present in Magic Realm. Well, sure enough, natives are now going to be in Dragons Down. There is a campaign right now up on Kickstarter. It is Dragons Down Natives and Legends, and I was actually reasonably pleased with the price level. I don't know. I might back it. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to flag that this element brings it yet more in line with the full suite of options available to your Magic Realm experience. Dragons Down Natives and Legends.
Speaking of enhancing an experience, Mark, we like Doomrock. And in case you missed out on Doomrock, it will be back up on crowdfunding soon. It is called Assault on Doomrock Party Hard Expansion. And I can almost rest assured that the full game will also be available. I don't know that 100%. Usually with these crowdfunding things, they are.
But there's going to be a new party modifier where you can, at the start of the game, determine that your entire party is of a particular type, giving you new benefits and burdens. Knowing Doomrock, it's probably going to be the kind of thing where the burdens are very transparent and obvious and burdensome, and the benefits are only able to be leveraged if you're playing real well. But that's the kind of challenge that I like Doomrock for, so I am looking forward to this expansion. Finally, for me, on a serious note, I have been following, like much of the rest of the world, with a sense of dread and sympathy what's been going on in the Los Angeles area and the fires. And I just want to amplify a GoFundMe for friends of the podcast that lost their home and all of their belongings therein. They are now trying to raise funds. This is a fine homestead in which there were games of The King's Dilemma and Revive played. And so, therefore, these are people that deserve your support. There's a link to the GoFundMe campaign in the episode notes. If you know other gamers or friends of the pod or appreciators of the pod who need support, please let us know. We are going to amplify whatever we can. So Very Wrong About Games has already made a donation to this particular GoFundMe as well as other charities. It's a truly appalling situation. And although we are a board gaming podcast, we would like to do what we can to help. So that is the news and why, as Walker would say, it sometimes matters. We now move on to our topic, which is only at certain player counts.
So, Mark, I'm sure we have a big list of games. I have some categories. Do you have any? Do you want to do it by category and try to fit your games in that way?
I might have my own categories. Go ahead.
Categories too.
Socket.
All right. So we're talking about games that just we feel play better at certain player counts, and I think the biggest one of this or category would be time. Some games just take too long at certain player counts, and this is mostly due to downtime and other things. I've only thrown two games in here because I'm sure that there are many, many others, but a Mage Knight is a big one where you are managing your deck and or your hand, and you have long turns of combat and moving around, and turns just take a long time. If you play at the full player count, it's painful.
Yeah, it's not even just that turns take a long time. It's that it's very puzzly and there's nothing for other players to do during that. The broad category in which I would put Mage Knight is scales with players. The more players you add on to a game of Mage Knight, it's more or less a one-to-one correlation between player count and increased time load. So a three-player game will take roughly 50% longer than a two-player game, more or less. It's not strictly linear, but it's close to it. And a lot of games that even we really like, the intricate kind, whether they're co-op or not, tend to do that and just scale with players. Another one that we talk about all the time is Xenoshift. Xenoshift, we've played with more than two in the past, but we've regretted it. And it's just not really something we're inclined to do. This is also true of all the modular deck system games, which is to say all the ones by the Sadler brothers. So your Hour of Need, your Street Masters. And I'm willing to play them at the maximum player count, but I feel it. I feel that difference. A single-player game or a two-player game is lightning quick, whereas a four-player game is indeed often more than twice as long as a two-player game. And so, you know, Mage Knight and Xenoshift I definitely put in the bucket of with no more than two. Whereas Street Masters and Hour of Need, I'll do it with four, but I feel that extra time.
And there's some games that have just a ridiculous player count, and I just put one in here because it's always funny, that Caverna came with being able to play at seven.
Yeah.
Why would they do this? I am not sure.
Yeah.
Because you would have to be crazy.
I remember.
To play at seven.
I remember when Caverna came out and the retail price was around $100, and that was unfathomably expensive for a board game. And the response was to shrug and say, yeah, it came with seven sets of player components, and no one really knows why, because that sounds like a terrible way to ruin a good game. Oh, how the market has changed. I don't know whether, honestly, to my mind, I'm not sure which I prefer. Actually, I do know. So there's the way they did Caverna, which is they all seven player components, and then there's the new version of Agricola, which in some cases I'm willing to play at five, although that's pushing it, but you can't play with five. You have to get the add-on five and six player expansion. In an ideal world, I think they would sell such games with five player components and charge a reasonable price. I realize we don't live in that world anymore, but that's my preference.
So that's all I have for that, because I have quite a few categories. The next category I have is Share the Load. And I've talked about this a lot with War of the Ring and Rebellion, where there are really two-player games. But it's nice, and I know all this time I say it's better to share the load, you know, to spread it out so you don't remember things. I keep forgetting to say that they do actually have rules for four players that just
yes
break up. Where it's not really full turns, you're playing half a turn, where we normally just play it as a two-player game, but with four people, and that way you're just keeping track of everything, and it moves a lot faster. And I also have to emphasize that this is usually only done for a first play or a second play or reintroducing. Once people know, it's usually just left to the side as a two-player experience only.
Yeah, it's tricky. We talked about this a fair bit when talking about World Spanner or Duel of Ages. And it's I personally can't help but feel that there is an ideal range of either characters or a set of mechanisms to wrestle with in the context of these games. So going back to World Spanner, there's like kind of like a good number of characters to be able to deal with. And if there's too few, you're not doing enough on your turn and the game can drag. And if there's too many, you're going to let some of those details slide and not really exert some of the special abilities. And so, yeah, on the one hand, it seems like it's suboptimal to say it's a two-player game, but you can scale upwards if you want to. On the other hand, though, sometimes the actual two-player count isn't ideal, as you point out. So it's weird. It's rough. Sometimes it feels like you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
My next category is the conflict category. So these are just weird games that you need some sort of mix-up. Like at two players, it just seems like you're beating down on the same player over and over again. Like this comes up a lot in 1v-all games. When you play 1v-all games versus two players, I know you're usually doing abilities against the party, which is, you know, four different characters. So it seems like, oh, you're spreading out the damage or you're spreading out the badness. But when you're only playing two players, you're really just picking on the same player over and over again. So it benefits from having more than just two. I have other games, like Wonderland's War sort of also goes in the time thing where it's sort of a bag builder where it's area majority or conflict. It just would not play well with only two players just going against the same person over and over again, where it just plays better when you have more, but you don't want too many more because then it just takes too long.
Yeah, it's tricky because the bugbear in Wonderland's War is those conflicts where some players are not involved. And yeah, there's the betting. And yeah, it is sometimes fun to watch people drive themselves into the ground desperately trying to win an unwinnable fight. But of those pleasures, a little goes a long way. And that's one of I think it's fair to say that between the two of us, that's the biggest downside of Wonderland's War. Awkwardness of player count and the concurrent amount of time that it takes to play the game. Other than that, it's great. There's a lot to recommend it. It's just a little bit awkward in that in my head, I imagine there's some sort of universe with a precisely ideal configuration, but it seems elusive.
Now, the problem with this conflict category is that you get the ABC problem, where you'll have two players that fight each other, and a third or fourth player will swoop in and benefit from this. So it's this weird mash of having just enough players and not too few players.
Well, for me, the more interesting one is those conflict games with the possibility of diplomacy, deal-making, and alliances, right? So if you look back at even at games that I'm not particularly fond of, like the Game of Thrones games, no one wants to play those at small player counts because you don't get the opportunity for lots of other people to be involved. Similarly, a game that I prefer that is not very popular in these circles, Cosmic Encounter with three players or less is not really at its best, because what you want is the theoretical possibility for either the two sides to each have one ally, and so you get two against two. Or in some cases, you actually want the situation where someone could be ganged up on 3-on-1 for either the possibility of the reversal or just the ability to keep someone in check. And so that's the reason why most people will refuse to play Cosmic Encounter at fewer than four players. And for what it's worth, I agree with them. I wouldn't play Cosmic with three.
I have Cosmic in another category, so I'll talk about it later. Other games I have in this conflict is Food Chain Magnet really needs more than two players because you're like competing for all of these different customers. And if you only have two people, it becomes this. I meant to put this in the same sort of thing. Games that completely change at different player counts is very interesting as well. It just becomes a different game at two players as opposed to three or four players.
I would instead say what makes Food Chain Magnet so much better with three or four players is more that it allows for more market segmentation. It allows for more, because basically every player is trying to make the market suit their ability to satisfy it, either in terms of pricing or variety of foods or both. And if you've only got two players, that's going to just lead to not an interesting evolution of the market. Whereas that third player, that fourth player can really cause them to be able to upend these sort of stasis that you might develop at lower player counts.
Yeah, exactly the same for Hansa Teutonica. If you just have two players going back and forth, pushing each other in and out of these things, it just leads to a completely different experience unless you have more players.
Agreed.
The next category I have is theme, where you need a certain player count for the theme to sort of be pulled out of the game. Like, I'm talking about games like Diplomacy, where you really need the full seven. You need all of the world powers represented there.
Whoa, because of the theme? Wow.
Well, the theme is reenacting a certain war. So if you don't have someone representing every power that took place in that fight.
Wow.
And or there's other games that, you know, have, you know, certain parts of the map, you know, and if they're missing, then that map is open and it just changes the way the game is played.
Diplomacy.
And the theme doesn't come out like it would if you had a certain player count.
I would stay in... Okay, so this is one of those areas where I think the difference between theme and setting is useful, right? The setting of Diplomacy is, you know, great powers roughly at the age of the Great War. But the setting, I think, is so far removed from the play of Diplomacy, you could completely rename all the countries into made-up words or even species of duck. And I don't think that it would make any difference at all because...
But the feeling of the game would be different with what I'm saying.
I disagree. It would be slightly different. I grant you, maybe the duck species version where I represent the United Confederacy of the Southeastern Mallard is slightly different than if I get to write missives in the voice of the...
No, I don't mean it that way. I mean, like, the game would play different at different player counts if...
You're not listening to
me. If the white ducks weren't represented.
No, of course.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
is that
But that's not because of the setting. That's not because of the setting. That's because of the game design. What I'm suggesting is that Diplomacy is an abstract game masquerading as a historic... The theme of the game is... But in that sense, it is no different from any other negotiation game where, broadly speaking, you want more.
I suppose I shouldn't say the theme. I should say maybe the intended feel of the designer.
There you go. I agree. Yes.
And same thing with the title. There's a Tidal Blades game where it's supposed to be, you know, you're a bunch of people competing. So if you only have two or three players playing, it doesn't feel like this grand competition. It just feels like a couple people running around doing a bunch of silly things while giant monsters destroy the city.
Okay, fair enough. I could see that.
Next up, I have player power balance. This will be games like Space Yelling Times 2, Root, and Rising Sun, where...
Space Alert?
No, Space Yelling Times 2.
Space Yelling.
So we have Sidereal Conflicts, Confluence, and or Cosmic Encounter.
Okay, those are two very different games.
They are very different, but the way they're designed is to have multiple powers playing against each other in order to balance the game out. And if you don't have enough players and enough powers represented, then it sometimes goes off the rails.
Well, in the context of Sidereal Confluence, Space Yelling 2, Space Yelling 2 Electric Boogaloo, I think it's more that since play is mostly simultaneous, you're not actually adding much in terms of playtime. You're certainly not adding any downtime because it's all
simultaneous. No, I'm not saying this leads into the time thing.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, okay,
I know. I'm differentiating that. And thus, it is only to your benefit to have a more interesting economy. It's primarily the economy, I think, less so the actual asymmetry in terms of the powers or just the number of people going on, because there's going to be a different sets of demands and inputs for the various different kinds of goods based on the number of players. And if you have a small number of players, I am perfectly willing to play Sidereal Confluence at small player counts. But very often what you end up with is an extremely lopsided economy that you have to navigate. And sometimes that interacts with the player asymmetry in unsatisfying ways. In the context of Cosmic Encounter, that actually is one of those instances where I think there is a very clear sort of Goldilocks zone of ideal player count, and that would be 4 or 5, maybe 6, because a lot of the powers in Cosmic Encounter, where a lot of the fun is, only trigger when it is your turn. And so, yeah, you're involved in the game at all times, even in a player count of 7 or 8, whether or not you're playing with teams. But if a game goes by and you only get to use your power maybe once or even not at all, that's not ideal. And so, consequently, that is a pressure to keep the player count a little bit down in Cosmic. Space Yelling 1 and 2, jeez.
And then we have Root as well, you know, having two different factions. And depending on what factions they are, it might not play very well at 2. And I know in the book they have a huge chart in which you should cross-reference depending on your player count and who would like to play what. So that's exactly what I'm talking about. It just plays better at a certain player count.
Yeah, a different perhaps complementary category to the categories that you've been identifying. Root is one of those games where I'm almost only willing to play it at a certain player count. Because a lot of people are very picky with respect to player count. I would say we are, at our group, are medium picky. We are willing to play games at suboptimal player counts all the time. Although there are things we absolutely rule out. We've discussed a number of them already. But Root is approaching one where I get slightly more picky. I pretty much am only willing to play Root at 4. With 5, the downtime is too long. I might be willing to consider it if I knew everyone there was expert with their factions at least, if not all factions. And with 3, I don't think there's quite enough going on. I've done both, and I'm willing to do both again, but I'm getting there. Because I remember back in the day, there were a whole bunch of very popular Euros that people would only play at the quote-unquote ideal player count. I'm thinking of things like Princes of Florence, El Grande, that they would only play at 5. Taj Mahal, they would only play at 4. But then there are some games where I actually agreed with the consensus, like Verräter and Meuterer by Marcel-André Castelmerkel, only really with 4. There are 3-player rules, but don't bother. In part, that was because of what you're talking about here in terms of it was discussion-heavy, diplomacy-heavy, trading-heavy. In Meuterer as well, there was the issue of factionalism, so you wanted there to be 2-on-2 faction struggle. So I'm always amazed at some players who are willing to play any game at any player count, and then I'm also amazed at some people who are like, oh, that is slightly suboptimal at that player count. I would never consider doing such a thing. I mean, I respect those views, but they're not my own.
Next category I have is Bring the Chaos. I only have one here. I meant to put more games in here, but I thought the list was getting a little bit long, and I'm sure you might have some to add in here. I just have Formula Day in here. And
oh, my goodness.
And I feel as though Formula Day just benefits from more players.
Yeah, but it gets so long.
It does. I agree with newer players, and you have more players, it's long. If you have experienced players, it usually goes at a fairly quick clip. You roll a die, you move your car. You know, it goes fairly quickly that way when you're going through a...
It does. I mean, the big tragedy of Formula Day, it gets a lot right. There's a lot to like about Formula Day. And indeed, what you do on your turn is so quick and simple. And yet, miraculously, the game is still taking far too long. And then at that point, the fact that your turns are so short becomes a detriment, not a positive, because you feel like you're spending only 1% of the time actually playing the
thing. How about if you get eliminated, Merc?
Yeah, how about if you... Yeah, no kidding.
So I think you can throw almost any racing game into this category, where they usually just play better at a fairly higher player count.
I think that's true, yeah.
There are some pseudo, you know, racing games that are geared towards smaller player counts, but in the majority of racing games, they play better at a higher player count.
Yeah, Matt Calkin's Brilliant Charioteer definitely falls into that. And there, most of the play is actual simultaneous, and so it works out very well. So there are a lot of games where, I don't know if this is in the chaos bucket, that are mostly indifferent to adding tons more people. So Codenames is a great example. You know, there's a minimum player count, which is probably 4 at a very, very, very smallest. And then, I mean, honestly, there's not a huge difference between playing with 10 and playing with 20. There's going to be more noise, sure. I'm not suggesting play it in the same venues or the same contexts, but you can get it done, and it doesn't... You don't feel like you're playing less of a game just because it's there. It works reasonably well. The same is true of a lot of social deduction games. You know, people may argue over the ideal player count for things like the Resistance, but if you're going to play Werewolf, or if you're so inclined to play Blood on the Clock Tower, the more the merrier. Might as well lord them all in.
Yeah, I did throw Hidden Roll into its own category, but yeah, I can go in with Bring the Chaos.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always good to have access to games that are very, very flexible. So, like, some games I think that should be in the category of too many people makes it too long but don't are ones where the flow is extraordinarily good. I'm thinking in particular of a game of Antica by Matt Gertz. The turns are so quick, and they're always quick. It never drags. I would happily play Antica with anything between 3 and 6, and that's not just because I love the game, but also because I'm always amazed at how quickly it moves at those higher player counts. Imperial is true, too. Imperial is a little bit trickier because it's fast in the same way as Antica, but then there's this whole issue of controlling great powers. There's always going to be the 6 great powers to control in Imperial, regardless of player count. Some people relish the prospect that during various phases of the game, some people are not going to be in control of any great power. Some people find that a great detriment to the game, so it depends on the mood of the players. personally speaking, I think it's interesting when I don't control a power or when some number of players don't control a power. So I'm happy to play it with any player count.
Ethnos sort of falls into that sort of category of the flow is real.
Yes.
And so high player counts is great.
Yes, absolutely. The downtime is going to be so minimal regardless, and it's going to move along at a good enough clip. Ethnos, if you play with a small enough player count, you're going to be only playing two rounds. I don't find that nearly as satisfying. So I think there's a solid minimum player count for Ethnos as far as I'm concerned.
And for the last category, I have auction and trading, because they just require a higher player count to just get that feeling of a battle. Like a two-player auction game is borderline. Don't get me wrong.
Okay, sorry, finish the sentence. You said borderline.
Because that's going to fall into the other category.
We're talking about Madonna now?
Where it complete, like there's a difference between large group auctioning and the totally different dynamic of two-player auctioning. Like, it completely changes the gameplay.
Have you
when
played...
you go from
yes.
two-player to multiplayer auctioning.
Have you played Raw with two?
No.
Shockingly good.
I might have.
Not. It's definitely not the ideal player count, but when it comes to auction games, I feel like depending on what you're auctioning, what the auction is actually leveraging, the auction mechanisms in particular, they can scale across almost any player count. So Blue Moon is a brilliant two-player auction game. Raw is a brilliant three-player auction game. Goa is a brilliant four-player auction game. Modern Art is a brilliant five- or six-player auction game. I mean, I'm not saying Modern... I would play Modern Art with fewer, for what it's worth. I'm just saying that depending on how the auction works, you can go to almost any player count. I agree with you that your characterization for some auction games, you want more people involved. Modern Art being a good example, but...
And trading games, like... Catan two-player would be grossly painful.
Well, again, it depends. I agree with you. The base version of Catan, absolutely. But there's the Starship Catan versions that we played.
Yes.
Where trading is not an option. There is the two-player, it's currently called the Rivals of Catan, or Catan Rivals, the two-player card game where...
Yeah, they're specifically made for two players.
Yes, and there's the option of trading in that game, but it almost never happens. But yes, I agree with you. Yeah, we're kind of... I feel like one of the refinements of more contemporary game design idioms is you see fewer and fewer games that are designed explicitly for fixed player count outside the consim sphere. In the realm of historical wargaming, you tend to find more and more... generally speaking, a higher proportion of games that are designed for specific player counts. Like the coin games, for example, are pretty much designed for their player count and none other. Typically three, four, or five. Or Successors is best with four. I play it with three. And this has been true for decades. But in Euro games, I think that flexibility in terms of player count is at a great premium. And so you see more and more games that scale from one to five well.
That's what I was looking for. Even if you reflect back on some, we've talked about a few Euros, but not very many. And I think Euros tend to do better at this because they're, I don't want to generalize, a lot of them are heads down sort of.
True.
You know, you're doing your own thing. So it really doesn't matter, you know, as opposed to, you know, just making the game longer, how many players you're playing with.
Sure. I would point to some exceptions being the things like the Renner Knizia tile laying games. Some people think that Tigris and Euphrates doesn't scale well. I disagree. I think it does. But almost everyone agrees that Through the Desert scales exceptionally well. Then there are... I agree that Raw feels very different at different player counts, but I would play it in any player count. I respect that some people don't want to play it with five. Refusing to play it at four seems a bit excessive to my mind, but yes, it is different from three to four to five. And El Grande is, I think, one of the classic examples. I'm perfectly willing to play it with four, but I agree that it is better with five. And that is precisely just because of how the auction works. That is an example of an auction game where you want more people involved because the goods divvied up is always going to be the same. There's always going to be those five things that you're auctioning with those power cards. And so you might as well want there to be a little bit more tightness in the market so the competition feels more real. And that's to say nothing of the Ari Majori on top of that. So
I'm sure everyone that's listening also has their opinions. So feel free to come onto the guild or into the Discord and let us know what games that you like to play at certain player counts.
And any rules errors we've made, as
yes.
always, support at aircanada.ca. That's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your deciding to having to spend some of your most valuable resource, your time. As always, take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and thank your rules explainer. Take care, everyone.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tomtandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.